Hi everybody, I'm Steve Pearce. I work with lawyers on career transformation. And in the last year, I've seen a real increase in people coming to me saying they want a completely different direction. Maybe you're in that category. Maybe you're fed up with the 24/7, always on culture. Maybe you just want to do something completely different, shake things up. This podcast, Project Pivot, is all about lawyers who change it up. We'll be sharing a whole range of stories, from people who've started their own business to people who've retrained as psychotherapists or teachers. And I'm really looking forward to sharing these stories with you. Welcome back, everyone. So a bit of a departure for this, the final episode of the first series. So far, we've been looking at the routes people have taken when they've decided to pivot away from law or big law. Today, we're going to look at one of the reasons why they might decide to take that new direction. Burnout is a phrase that's often used but seldom understood. So I'm delighted to welcome as my guest today one of the world's leading authorities on the subject. Professor Gordon Parker has over 50 years' experience as a clinician and a researcher. He founded the Black Dog Institute and is head of the School of Psychiatry at the University of New South Wales. In 2020, he was awarded the Australian Mental Health Prize. His latest book is called Burnout: Pathways to Recovery. So in this interview, you will learn what burnout is, how to identify it, and how to recover from it. Well, first of all, thank you so much for joining us. It's a real pleasure to have you on the podcast. I read the book, and we'll be certainly putting links to the book in the show notes. I know you're going to hold it up for us at some point during the conversation as well. But the key point that I took away and was fascinated by, and I really wanted to hear your thoughts on, is the analogy between soil and seed that you use throughout the book. And I guess those of us in a sort of legal context or corporate context might imagine that actually the environment is mainly responsible for our feeling burned out. Yet there's a key chapter in the book where you talk about personality, and you say that actually certain types of personality can be considered to be the key predisposing risk factor in terms of burnout. I'd really like to hear your thoughts on that.
So the dominant model for the last 40 years has focused on the precipitating factors, the stressors, the drivers. And there have been many statements put that the whole story about causes of burnout is simply due to the precipitating factors, and the individual brings nothing to the table. In our research, in our very first study, we actually found that there was a distinct personality contributor. And that is, the people the most likely to develop burnout are dutiful, reliable, conscientious, if not perfectionistic. So if I do a little bit of a backtrack here, when we look at the epidemiology of burnout, we find it's overrepresented in two broad groups. There's one group that you can call the caregiving groups, the doctors, the nurses, the teachers, particularly the clergy. They're probably the highest ranked group in terms of the caregivers, veterinarians and so on. Also, we find, again, against the dominant model of burnout, that it only affects people in paid work. In fact, burnout can also affect caregivers. And during COVID, many parents, particularly mothers, were not only required to do their job, but to look after their kids, if not their aging, frail parents, the so-called sandwich generation. And therefore, they were put under major caring stresses. So I think the concept of people who are dutiful and reliable explains the overrepresentation in the caring professions. Because if you are a good carer, you have to be dutiful, you have to be reliable. You have to say after your shift is finished, well, look, you know, the hospital ward is still full of problems and I'm not going to go home yet. So I think that explains the issue in regard to caregivers. And then the second group, and it's well represented by lawyers, are the group of people where the job demands that you are absolutely reliable. So if you go into the legal profession and you write a document, there are not going to be any split infinitives. It's going to be perfect. It has to be perfect. So the legal profession also requires people to be dutiful, reliable, if not perfectionistic. Whether it's a doctor, nurse, or a lawyer, of course, there's going to be a slight overrepresentation of people with those characteristics who go into those professions. But even if there's no overrepresentation, the profession demands that you bring that to the table. And so the importance of this is that it fits in with the general model that we have for psychological and psychiatric conditions, which we call a diathesis stress model. Diathesis means that there are predisposing factors, which are commonly genetic, but they can also be personality, as in this instance, and then precipitating factors, which are the stresses that bring on burnout. The importance of allowing that richer model is that it has major implications for management. Because if you just see burnout as a consequence of excessive stress, you'd say to a person, well, turn off your emails at 6 o'clock and do mindfulness and meditation. But if, in fact, the person is burnt out as a consequence of bringing their personality into the equation, then it seems to me it makes total common sense that you seek to address that personality component.
This is a real challenge, of course, because it's that very personality component that has enabled a lot of our audience to achieve the level of success they've achieved. How do they begin to make some progress here without, in essence, destroying their ability to perform at the level they need to perform at, as they see it?
I think, firstly, to recognize if they have burnout or are at risk of burnout, that their personality may be making a contribution. And once it's recognized, then, of course, they can make a decision to do something about it or not. In the book, because of our emphasis on this particular issue, I asked a psychologist to write a chapter where he basically looked at people who were extreme perfectionists. For instance, the boss that had to check everything before his underlings allowed, any particular product to go out of the office. That put incredible demands on him, but also on his underlings. So the psychologist said, you have to stop checking, and commanded him to do that. When he stopped checking, despite his expectations that it would be a disaster and that the firm would go bankrupt, very little happened, and his underlings appreciated him for the first time. And the second example, in a similar situation, the boss was required to send out a damaged good. The boss thought, okay, this is definitely going to bring the business to its knees. What happened? Somebody rang him up and said, oh, mate, we got a bit of a faulty product. Sorry to worry about it, but would you mind sending out? No catastrophe, no disaster, et cetera, et cetera. So in those more extreme examples where you have a clinician involved, and I think that's very relevant if a person's personality is really distinctively along this line of the spectrum, then in fact strategies like that are important. I'll just sidetrack for a little bit. When we reviewed the literature on strategies for helping burnout, then in fact a meta-analysis showed that the most common therapeutic strategy was a cognitive behavioral approach. And it didn't show any benefits. And I think the reason is that it was using cognitive behavior therapy to focus on the stresses, but not cognitive behavior therapy to focus on the predisposing personality. In the more common scenario, where it's not quite so pathological and the individual is being dutiful, then I think that if they contemplate the question and say, yes, I am excessively dutiful, then I think there are a number of things they can do, particularly to avoid the eat, sleep, work, repeat paradigm. So, for example, I saw a general practitioner only as recently as last week with burnout symptoms. She worked from 8 o'clock to 6 o'clock in her office. And then she went home and she worked till 12 o'clock at night writing up reports. And I made the simple, if not banal, suggestion, obviously, that she stop work at 6. And she was quite prepared to give that a go because she recognized the model and its relevance to her. So I think that there's going to be a clear spectrum, and there's going to be a level of varying compliance along that spectrum. One of the difficulties in this area, and I used to work to the injunction of never trying to treat perfectionists, but trying to employ them, is that if you are extremely perfectionistic, you have great difficulty in surrendering up that component and tweaking it at all, because you're so used to being in control. If your boss is to say to you, look, we recognize you've got some burnout, you must reduce your hours or we must take time off, the dutiful, reliable, perfectionistic individual has great difficulty in accepting that advice. And that's where it can become extremely difficult at a management level if the individual doesn't buy in. And the extreme perfectionists generally don't like to admit to any problems. If they're pointed out to them, they tend to deny, and they have great difficulty in seeing anybody at a therapeutic level because they're used to being in control themselves. They don't like handing over control. So it can be difficult, but I stick with my main point, Steve, is that if it's relevant, then the individual should look at it, think about it, and work out how they can tweak and modify that particular personality component as they apply it to their job.
Hi, everyone. This is Steve interrupting the interview very quickly just to say that if you are considering a career change of any kind, why not check out our website at projectpivot.co.uk, where we've got a whole range of free resources for you that I think you might find helpful. So do check it out, projectpivot.co.uk. Let's get back to the interview. Let's talk for a moment about warning signs, because, again, a really noticeable and memorable part of the book was where you made it very clear that this is not just about exhaustion.
Yeah.
Right? That's one of the factors, but there are others.
The dominant model since the 1980s has been what I call a triadic model. And that's come out of work done by a US psychologist, Christina Maslach. She developed the Maslach Burnout Inventory, and it measures three components: emotional exhaustion, then a second component called depersonalization, which is sometimes seen as lack of empathy or compassion fatigue, and then compromised work performance. Now, there may only then be, and that's the ICD, International Classification of Diseases definition. But of those three symptoms, there may only be two, because compromised work performance may be a consequence of the first two. We started from scratch and threw 150 questions at people with burnout to find what were the additional components, were there any. And a very important one came up, and that's cognitive impairment. So burnout is the term that was introduced in 1980, but the syndrome itself goes back many centuries. So in the 5th century, the Catholic Church was struck by an epidemic of burnout amongst their priests. The priest would wake up one day and say, the sun is no longer shining, the sky isn't blue, I've lost my faith in God, and I'm not getting anything out of life. And that was called echidia and regarded as the 8th cardinal sin. And it was only later, in the 5th century, that Pope Gregory joined echidia together with tristitia, depression, to create the 7 cardinal sins. But the importance of that issue, as I've detailed it, is that cognitive impairment was a key descriptor in the definition of echidia, but it's not in the common definition of burnout as it is today, and yet it is extremely common. So what people with burnout will say or admit to is, my brain is very foggy. I just can't take in information as readily as I used to be able to do. When I read, I tend to skim. And of course, that's going to be very relevant for lawyers to have compromised work performance. In addition, people become very insular. They keep to themselves. So instead of going off with their colleagues to have lunch, they might just go off to the canteen by themselves and keep to themselves. And rather than a loss of empathy, which can certainly occur, although I've had surgeons with burnout who say for the first time in their life, having a psychological problem, they've had more empathy. Basically, it's a loss of feeling tone rather than just loss of empathy. People feel that they're just not getting much pleasure out of anything. And as a consequence, then that drives the withdrawal. But along with that can go a lot of physical symptoms. So in the book, in the final chapter, we have a professional, and I'm prepared, even though we don't say it in the book, but I'm prepared to say that she has had a very successful legal career. When she went into burnout, she just couldn't get out of bed for a few days. And when her family took her to hospital, her blood pressure was 60 over 40, as against the usual 120 over 80. And she had a distinct tachycardia. No one in the emergency room knew what was going on, but it was profoundly physical. There's another book written by a young Sydney doctor called Emotional Female, and she became incontinent when she had burnout. What's happening in the brain? There are a whole series of components evidencing compromised function in the brain at the functional level and the structural level, but there is also compromised immune functioning. So a number of people with burnout would describe an increase in infections. So we've got the central set of symptoms, exhaustion being the key feature, cognitive impairment, lack of feeling tone, insularity, they'll be the dominant ones, and then the compromised work performance. But then you can have the physical symptoms. And in addition, there are a number of others, but I won't sort of detail them too much. Yeah.
That's been really helpful. So you've just outlined there a number of the warning signals that people should be taking note of or be aware
of. Yes, I would emphasize the two that I think that people should focus on are the exhaustion, the emotional exhaustion, and the cognitive impairment.
And as you say, particularly with our audience, cognitive impairment will translate directly to the quality of their work product. So it's a vicious circle, I guess, that they need to address.
Yes, and if you're experiencing burnout, but you feel that you have to keep on doing your job, you become like Sisyphus rolling the rock up. So you keep on, doing your legal tasks. And if you're cognitively impaired, it's harder. But the average reliable, dutiful lawyer with burnout will just keep struggling.
You say in the book that burnout can be an opportunity for renewal, which is fascinating in the context of our podcasts and everything we've been talking about. What did you mean by that? I think people will be surprised to hear that.
I have to go back a little bit. We hear people say they're burning out. We hear people say they're burnt out. There's nothing in the literature to suggest a difference. I think there may be. And I don't know how many of your people in the audience remember from their physics lessons at school about Hooke's law. But Hooke's law says that if you stretch a body within its elastic range, it will come back to normal. If you stretch it beyond its range, it loses elasticity and won't come back. So I think if you are burning out, you probably are still in the elastic frame. And if you do some sensible things, talk to your boss, reduce your hours, take away the stress, play golf twice a week, blah, 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 meditation and mindfulness, then in fact your burning out stage can be brought under control. However, if you're burnt out, that much more finite state, then I think you have to reevaluate your life. And it becomes an opportunity to decide, quo vadis, where might I go next? And again, that woman that I mentioned in the final chapter, Grace, was a senior in one particular profession. She took a couple of years off. She reevaluated her life. She looked at her priorities. She rejigged them. And she came up with a really good mix, and she's now extremely successful in another profession, but she's got the work-life balance pretty well under control. So I think that's what I largely mean by opportunity to look at your life and say, where have I been going, and is there a benefit in changing the trip description?
There's some fascinating data in the book in terms of the people that you've been working with. And there's one table in particular that I'm thinking of where you list the techniques or the strategies that people have deployed when they have discovered that they are burned out.
Mm.
And you list them by frequency, how often have people done these things, and you also list them by effectiveness.
Mm.
And number three on the list really fascinated me because although a very small, well, 24% of the sample have actually tried it, a whopping 79% said it was hugely effective. And that tactic, of course, was quitting your job. drastic, of course, but really interesting on this theme of crossroads, decisions in life, moving on in a different direction, perhaps.
Yes. If I could offer a few observations here. The number one strategy that people voted for was talking to somebody about the problem. Unfortunately, we didn't get specifics. We don't know whether that meant talking to their boss, talking to their co-workers, talking to their partner, whatever. But we know that getting it out is very important. Then after that was exercise, and it had to be stressful exercise. And then after that came a few psychological strategies, but of those, mindfulness and meditation were top of the pops. Interestingly, we also found that a significant percentage of people said that they'd been tried on an antidepressant and they found it quite effective. That surprised me because if antidepressant drugs were effective for burnout, why weren't the pharmaceutical companies out there 20 years ago spruiking? What we subsequently found is that in our sample of people with burnout, a number of them had a background history of depression or some other psychological problem. And when they were saying that the antidepressant was helpful for their burnout, when we pursued it, it may have been for that group. But in those with pure burnout and no background history of depression, then very few of them were put on antidepressants and it wasn't relevant. So I think it's important to state that antidepressants have seemingly no role in this whole story. But again, bouncing off your question, one of the commonest paradigms that I face that's extremely sad is if I get a public servant working for the government who's burnt out and we're just not functioning and the employer is saying, you're going to have to take time off and the HR department is involved and it's just getting worse and worse and worse. And I say to that individual, look, you're not going to win in this scenario. You have to leave your job and reinvent yourself in some other position. 98% of the time, I have no success in persuading them. And the reality is, because of their personality again, they love their job. They are reliable and they're dutiful. And they could testify saying, if I leave, who's going to handle it? Blah, 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 blah. So that's another nuance in terms of management, that if you've got an employee like that, or if you are somebody like that, you really need to think seriously as to whether your dutifulness, your reliability is now not only driving your burnout, but in this instance, is preventing you from moving on.
There is an assumption, I think, that because we talk about these issues more than we used to, that we are becoming, both at a societal level and an organizational level, more effective at dealing with them. Is that so?
I'm not sure. There are two comments I'd offer. One is most people are comfortable talking about being burnt out or burning out. That's a higher percentage of people with the condition compared to people with depression. talking about their depression. So we have clearly destigmatized burnout. On the other hand, we may have destigmatized it so much that it's now being used superficially and excessively. So somebody has just had a, you know, extremely busy couple of days working in a hospital, and there's no juice left in them, might say as they're walking out the building, "I'm burnt out." But all they're doing is in reality, what they're experiencing is just exhaustion from an excessively long burst of work, and they have a decent weekend, they're back and firing on Monday. So I think we have to recognize that we've destigmatized it, but there is a slight risk of the term being used excessively when it may not be entirely appropriate.
And I've also heard you talking about the fact that the way these conditions are treated often depends not on the presentation, but on the specialization of whoever it is that you consult.
Absolutely.
Is there a sense that actually the medical profession, psychological profession, whatever, still has a bit of a way to travel in terms of matching really relevant treatment to each individual case?
I think there are two problems here. One is that if we look at, say, depression, and you have depression in Australia or in the UK, and you go to seek help, then basically the treatment, the intervention you get is largely determined by the background training or discipline of the practitioner. So if you go to a GP, you'll get an antidepressant drug. You go to a psychologist, you'll get cognitive behavior therapy. You go to a counselor, you get counseling. You go to a lady wearing a kaftan and you'll get crystal therapy. Now, that's against the whole paradigm in medicine, which basically says, what's the diagnosis here and what's the specific intervention? And similarly with burnout, we've got the problem that the background discipline of the practitioner is going to likely dictate the treatment you get. There is a second problem that by and large, the great majority of general practitioners, and this is not to criticize them, in my country, the average GP does a wonderful job. And they're actually pretty well trained in depression these days, but they haven't been trained in burnout. None of us have. In fact, until we got involved in our research, and despite me being a psychiatrist for decades, never as a medical student, never as a psychiatry trainee, never as a psychiatrist, did I ever get exposed to a lecture on burnout. So the average person with burnout going to a general practitioner or a primary practitioner will probably get an antidepressant drug or cognitive behavior therapy, and more worryingly, we'll probably get a diagnosis of depression.
So self-awareness and being able to identify those stressors and those symptoms is incredibly important. In your book, there's a great tool for that, right? You've got a questionnaire in the back of the book that will help.
Yeah, but I have to offer a caveat in regard, as you point out in the book, several appendices, including a 34-item measure of burnout. Now, if you've got burnout, you will score high on that measure. And we generally suggest that people need to score 45 or more. However, there can be false positives. So people with severe depression, people who are profoundly anemic, people who are getting chemotherapy may also score high. And that is a problem with all burnout measures, the problem of false positive diagnosis, if you like. Manufacturers of most measures don't admit to that problem. So basically, we suggest in the book, do the questionnaire, but also you need clinical reasoning. And if you're not going to do it yourself, although obviously the book is encouraging people to do that, then when you see a practitioner, then your practitioner must be doing that for you. And again, come back to the fact that most practitioners aren't trained. It is not an uncommon issue when I see somebody, is this depression or is this burnout? And yes, for burnout, I expect that they'll have the key symptoms that I've mentioned. But in addition, I focus on the driver, the precipitate. If it's depression, it's much more likely to be a stressor where their self-esteem is compromised or injured. Somebody has told them that they are absolutely hopeless in their relationship and they're going to, you know, reject them, or they've been criticized or fired by a boss and their self-esteem is on the line, it's been compromised. That's the common precipitant for depression. For burnout, it's the impact of multiple demanding ongoing stresses. So in fact, it's so important to differentiate the two. And while the measure is of some help in suggesting the possibility, getting a high score should not be taken as a definitive statement. It should be taken as a, okay, it's a possibility, now I need to check out using a clinical reasoning approach. In the same way that when you use a thermometer, if it's the reading is high, that tells you that you're febrile, but it doesn't say you've got a particular condition.
This has been absolutely fascinating. I direct everyone to the book and we'll make sure we reference it fully in the show notes. But for now, Professor Park, thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Okay, so there we go. That's the end of our first series. Many thanks to the 6 people who agreed to be interviewed during the series and to all of you for listening and watching. We will be back later in the year, so if anyone has any ideas for subjects for future interviews, please do get in touch. The website, projectpivot.co.uk. Thanks for listening.